The Tom Woods Show, episode 2016.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, chances are if you're listening to this podcast, you are surrounded by irrational, panicked people who think you're a terrible person because you don't want to lock everybody in their houses. No amount of reasoning appears to accomplish anything. And not to mention the media has done nothing but stoke fear and fail to provide context. Well, one of the many benefits you get as a supporter of The Tom Woods Show is membership inside The Tom Woods Show Elite. Recently migrated off Facebook, so if that was holding you back, no longer. This group will keep you sane and informed, and as an added bonus, it won't accuse you of wanting to kill your grandmother. Join me in there at supportinglisteners.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. We're going to talk about inflation today because that topic is in the news because the phenomenon is very much before us. But before I get to that, a couple of things I want to let you know about. The first involves our friend Gene Epstein, who, as director of the Soho Forum, has moderated many debates on issues of concern to libertarians and indeed to all people. And he has one coming up December 8th, 2021, on the subject of vaccine mandates. And it's going to feature Ilya Soman for the affirmative. And the resolution is, while vaccine mandates are an infringement on freedom, some are justified due to their big payoff in lives saved. So for the affirmative, Ilya Soman, and for the negative, Angela McArdle, who has been a guest on The Tom Woods Show several times, and she was at my 2000th episode event. So you can attend this in person, but of course you'll unfortunately need to show proof of vaccination. Poor Gene is in an impossible situation. So what he's done, not only is there a live stream option available, so you can cheer on Angela from wherever you are, but Gene is opening up his own home, his own apartment for a live stream event where you can just attend regardless of your health status and be with a whole bunch of like-minded people. And so that's about the best Gene can do under the circumstances, and it's hard to ask for more than a guy actually opening his house to you. So get the details on this at thesohoforum.org. That's where you get your tickets. And go support Gene, and let's hope for saner times ahead. The second thing I want to tell you is I am very sad to report the death of Tom Woods Show guest David Longdon from episode 1409. I know this won't be terribly meaningful to a whole lot of listeners, but it's very meaningful to me. And I would say I've never had the death of a musician affect me quite this much. But David was the singer for the best band you've never heard of called Big Big Train. Their album English Electric, either parts one or two, or the whole thing English Electric Full Power, is one of my favorite pieces of music ever. And he was 56 years old. And all we know is that he took a fall at home and died. And it's just shocking. When Phil Collins left Genesis, David was considered to replace him. So he had an excellent reputation, maybe my favorite rock voice of all time, possibly. And he played 100 instruments, and he was just a great person. And I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation Brad Berzer and I had with him in episode 1409. But it's really, really sad, because he was such a talented guy, and by all accounts, such a good guy. That comes through in our episode. So in his honor, I'm going to put together a little playlist that you can listen to some songs over on Spotify. I'll have it at tomwoods.com/David. You know, maybe just four or five songs that I happen to like. And just give them a listen and raise a glass to David Longdon, a great, great, tremendous talent and a terrible, terrible loss. All right, now let's move on to our subject for today. For a long time, people in our tradition have been saying that prices are bound to start going up, and they're, you know, going up faster than the 2%, let's say, implicit target of the Fed. And now, of course, we're seeing that. We're seeing numbers that are very unpleasant to see about where prices are in the economy right now. And we're getting fallacious responses to this. So the main one of these comes from Elizabeth Warren. And if you followed her on Twitter at all, you've heard her say that what's happening here is that companies are greedy, and they've become greedy, and they are raising prices to take advantage of you because they know they can get away with it. And this is their terrible greed. Now, I don't know if she actually believes that or if she just knows that dumb people will go for that. And she relies on a combination of dumb people and midwits to get reelected. Now, midwits, remember, are not stupid. I don't know, maybe they're people with like 100 or 105 IQ. So I don't know, maybe a little higher even, maybe 110. These are people who have minds that are good enough to repeat for you what Dr. Fauci said, and they'll know the arguments in support of what Dr. Fauci said, but that's about the level where they are. They can tell you, but you know, we need to practice social distancing as if you haven't heard that already, and they think they're being real smart and stuff. It's a combination of those and really, really envious people who combine to elect Elizabeth Warren. So maybe she's just saying what she thinks is going to help her. But obviously, this is not true. For example, if the oil companies are greedy for asking for such and such price of oil, were they just not greedy 3 years ago, you know, when the price was much lower? Does the intensity of their greed just fluctuate? What kind of an explanation is this? So if prices suddenly fall by 3%, did they just get 3% less greedy? So she acts as if and speaks as if prices are determined completely arbitrarily, that there's nothing governing them other than the desires of producers to satisfy their greed. But this, of course, is no explanation at all. I mean, obviously, if the explanation is greed, why weren't they greedy last year? Why did they just decide to become greedy now? Or if they could get away with, let's say, doubling their prices, and Elizabeth Warren would say, look at how greedy they are, they've doubled their prices, wouldn't they want to triple their prices? Why don't they triple their prices? Why don't they quadruple their prices? If there's no set of laws or irregularities in human life, why don't they just do that? If we're just enthralled to them, why don't they set the price at infinity? Like if you want a loaf of bread, you're just going to have to labor for these people as a slave for the rest of your life. I mean, why wouldn't they do that? So obviously something else is going on apart from so-called greed. Greed was also supposed to have caused the financial crisis of 2008. We got a lot of that. Greed caused that. Okay, so why were people not greedy in 2005 or 2000 or 1986 or whenever? Like, why does greed seem to move only in a cyclical pattern? Isn't that strange? Seems kind of strange. So what exactly is going on? Well, of course, when there's more money in the economy, this has the tendency to push prices up. Now, sometimes that does not mean that prices go up all that much. But the point is, in the absence of the inflation, prices would have gone up not at all or possibly even declined. But we don't see that because we didn't live in that alternate reality. We see only the reality in which prices move steadily upward. And we convince ourselves that it's not a big deal because the price increases are only small every year. But number one, that small increase accumulates over time. 2% a year accumulates over time. But again, as I say, we could have been having prices declining every year, the way they typically do in the technology sector. When we look at personal electronics, those things tend to go down in price or stay the same price but have more benefits and more features, which is the equivalent of their declining in price. We could have had that, but we don't have that because of what? Because of there being more money in the system. Now, there are a lot of ways people try to explain the rise in prices other than by just pointing out, honestly, there's more money sloshing around. One of them is greed, as we've seen with Elizabeth Warren. Another one is things like, let's say, the cost-push style of argument, which would be to say, this, we see this a lot in the popular press or in popular understandings. If, let's say there is a rise in oil prices. Well, some people may say, well, that rise in oil prices, that's going to lead to a general inflation of prices. Now, by the way, I keep saying price inflation to distinguish from inflation, because in the old days, inflation was defined as an increase in the money supply. And if you had a metallic system like a gold standard, then inflation would be an increase in the supply of paper money beyond the amount of gold that it could be redeemed into. Well, then they changed inflation just to mean price inflation, just to mean prices going up. But it used to just mean the increase in the supply of money. And everybody knew that an increase in the supply of money meant that prices would go up. But now they want to obscure what the source of the prices going up is. So now inflation is just prices going up. You know, who knows what could have caused this? Prices are going up. So I specify price inflation because you've had inflation, the increase in the money supply, for quite some time. So price inflation specifically refers to what happens to prices as opposed to what happens to the money supply. But they're connected. There's a connection between the two. Now, we can go through, as I say, a variety of other explanations. I want to look at the cost push one because I find that that's at the root of so much of the mistaken way of thinking that a lot of people have about this. Because wage push or crisis push, there's a big crisis in the world and that makes prices go up, or the credit cards, people are using credit cards and that can make general prices go up without an increase in the money supply. They all basically are products of the same fallacy that you see in the simple cost push variant. That, let's say, again, something as crucial as oil prices. They'll say oil really makes the world go round. And it fuels not just our cars, but it is a major energy source. And of course, for transportation, it's indispensable. So if the price of that goes up, because it's intertwined, because oil is intertwined with so many other things, if not the entire economy, then it should be no surprise that prices in general all have to rise in connection with the rise in oil prices specifically. Well, here's the problem, and here's the fallacy there. And this fallacy is going to rear its head in every variant of the cost push thesis. It's simply this. If there weren't an increase in the money supply, where would people be getting all this money to buy all these goods at all these suddenly higher prices? Where would the money come from? You have a budget. You have a certain amount you can spend on certain things per month. And if one of those things has a price increase and you really, really need that thing, you'll keep buying that thing in its previous quantity, but you now have less money with which to buy other things. So even though your spending on oil at the higher price will support it at that higher price, your abstention from spending on other things will lead to those prices going down, relatively speaking. And so it's a wash. So there's no way that there could be a general price increase in everything because oil prices rise. Yeah, maybe people feel like oil is indispensable to their lives and business firms likewise, and so they'll pay the extra amount for it. But that just means they have less money to spend, to demand labor, to buy other intermediate inputs, and likewise for households. You have to spend more on gas, you have less money for restaurant meals. You have less money for clothing. And so there's downward pressure on the prices of these other things. So there's no general rise in prices. The only way there could be a general rise in prices would be if there was more money in the economy that could support all these general rises in prices, that whereby people could continue at their previous level of consumption of all goods, even at the higher price level. Where are they going to get the money for that? Where's that going to come from? Now, I've done an awful lot on this subject, and again, probably most of it has been in the first millennium of the Tom Woods Show. I will just say the first 1,000 episodes, that's where you can find my material on this primarily. And I've gone through and given the arguments for why it's better to have a sound money. When we say sound money, what we mean is simply that it's money that the government can't just arbitrarily manipulate, the government or its privileged central bank. Because gold has a fixed supply. You can mine more, but it's a time-consuming process, and more gold is introduced into circulation only very gradually. And in general, most other goods are increased in supply at a faster rate than gold. So if gold were actually the money, we would see that our purchasing power would increase over time. Now, one of the problems with a money whose value decreases all the time, there are numerous problems, especially if the money is really decreasing in value. Then business firms are wasting their time trying to hedge against this and doing things other than focusing on improving consumer welfare and expanding their business. But also just imagine the average person trying to save for the future. And you're saving dollars that are losing, let's say, 4 or 5% of their value a year. Okay, in couple of decades, even if it's just 2%, you're going to see a third of the value of that money is just gone. That's how you save for the future. So it makes saving unattractive which makes people more present-oriented and spending right away and seeking immediate gratification. Is that good for society? Is that good for individuals? Is that good for their financial situation? What are people supposed to do to hold on to that money? To hold on to the purchasing power of that money, I should say. They can't just save it because it will have its value whittled away. Now, in the old days, when gold circulated as money, it's not comparable to today where gold is a non-monetary commodity. When gold circulated as money in the old days, the gold and silver coins increased in value, in purchasing power over time. So strictly speaking, all you had to do was accumulate the coins and they would be worth more than they were in the past. Now, you could invest them in investment projects and then the returns would be even better than just sitting on them, but you could just sit on them. You didn't have to say, well, I guess I need to jump into the stock market, which I know nothing about, just in order to tread water financially. It is inexcusable that ordinary, vulnerable people have been placed in that unenviable position just to maintain the purchasing power of their money. Now, we get told all the time by people whose opinions we don't trust on anything that sustained falls in prices are a bad thing. So as soon as they tell you that, you know it's a good thing, right? You just know. And I don't think I would have spoken this way 20 years ago. But now I'm so cynical after observing the lizard people close up for all this time that if they tell me falling prices are terrible and to be avoided, I instantly know falling prices are a good thing. However, I also have some intellectual arguments for this. This is a commonplace, by the way. You read this in financial newspapers. You read it in the regular press. It's just taken for granted that sustained falls in the price level are associated with economic bad times. Well, there's an article in the American Economic Review that I cited in my 2009 book, Meltdown. I'll try and dig it out. I don't know if it's viewable online without having to pay, but it's an article by economists Atkinson and Kehoe, and they took a whole bunch of countries over about a 100-year period, and they just examined trends in prices and trends in economic prosperity, and they found that there is basically no connection whatsoever between periods of falling prices and bad economic activity. They said, we found more episodes of depression that corresponded with moments of price inflation than we did price deflation. So as an empirical matter, the connection between falling prices and economic hard times simply does not exist. So anyone just saying that as an offhand remark is uninformed. Okay, you win. You win against them because they're uninformed. It's not true. But let's take a little bit deeper look here at what's happening if prices are allowed to fall and what exactly is going on to make them fall. Why would prices fall in the absence of a constant increase in the money supply? What's actually going on here? Well, what's going on here is that without a constantly increasing money supply, you would have the following kind of scenario. I'm a factory owner. I produce widgets. And I make a profit producing those widgets. And I realize that I can make even more widgets and earn an even higher profit if I reinvest some of the profits from the widget sales into a big series of widget-making machines that can produce 5 times as many widgets as we used to be able to produce by hand. And so now I have 5 times as many widgets. I can sell way more widgets, and let's assume the market can bear these widgets. I can now make a higher profit. And I can, given that other widget manufacturers will probably be buying the widget machines also, they're going to be increasing their output. There will be a downward pressure on prices because competition will push those prices down because each of us can now afford to sell them more cheaply and we want to grab as many customers as possible. So this greater abundance of widgets is going to push prices down and it's going to increase everybody's standard of living and purchasing power of their money because now their money can buy more widgets. And by extension of this logic to other industries, we can now buy more of practically anything we want because we'll have a reinvestment of profits into the purchase of capital goods that produce still greater supplies of these consumer goods. These greater supplies coming out of multiple firms is going to lead to under competition, lowering of their prices. And so we're going to be able to buy more and more. Our existing paycheck, even without any nominal wage increase or raise or anything, will be able to extend farther and buy us more things. That's the process. Capitalism is taking us from this world of scarcity we live in into a world of less scarcity. We'll never have a world of zero scarcity. Zero scarcity recalls Rothbard's example of you wish for a Coke, and then all of a sudden the Coke is just flowing down your throat. That is a costless, zero-price world. We'll never get there. But we can, as prices get lower and lower, we can approach that world of scarcity conquered. We can approach that world of zero price. That's what capitalism does for the world through the process I've just described. The prices become lower and lower because the amount of gold, let's say, or whatever the monetary unit is, has increased only very marginally, but the supply of everything else has grown in great abundance. Well, you can do the ratio. So prima facie, we should look at this as capitalism, in effect, working out its destiny, as this being a glorious thing. And as I say, when we see personal computers fall in price, this is not a disaster. It's not that, well, those companies can't make a profit now because the price of the goods that they sell is constantly falling. No, they anticipate that. That's the job of an entrepreneur. The job of an entrepreneur is to anticipate what the price of the finished product will be at the time he's prepared to sell it. The role of the entrepreneur is to appraise the present and future situation and to adjust the employment of resources into such a configuration as to lead to the greatest value productive outcome at the time of sale. That's what the entrepreneur is supposed to do. So he is supposed to factor in all contributing factors into what will yield the price of his product in the future, including monetary policy. That's his job, is to anticipate that. And if he correctly anticipates that the price will be lower in the future than it is now, well, this doesn't mean it's impossible for him to make a profit. It doesn't matter where the price level is. Entrepreneurs can always make a profit. The only thing that matters is the difference between the price that the good is sold at and the cost to produce the good. That's all that matters. That differential right there between how much you can sell it for and how much it costs you to make it. And you can preserve that even in an environment of falling prices because the inputs that you buy to create the goods are also falling in price because you're not willing to pay as much for them because you've anticipated the fall in price. You're not going to be able to hire people at $50 an hour when you know that the price of your product is going to fall in half within 2 years. So you don't hire them at that wage rate. You hire them at a lower wage rate. And likewise for capital goods, you're not willing to bid as high for those things because you know that the products they're going to create aren't going to command as high a price. And so the market adjusts itself like this. Now, it's true, some entrepreneurs may fail to anticipate this. That's correct. But okay, well, entrepreneurs fail to anticipate the future state of the market all the time. It's unfortunate for those individuals, but the point is this does not damage the economy as a whole. What it means is these entrepreneurs who fail to anticipate the decline in prices go bankrupt. What happens when they go bankrupt? Do the capital goods they own and the physical plant they own just disappear into thin air? They're still there. They just get redeployed in bankruptcy proceedings to other people who may be better forecasters of consumer demand and the price level. And so, although it is, again, a misfortune for those people, it has no aggregate effect on the economy. This does not lead to bad economic times or such a thing like that. Another sort of thing, again, that you hear on social media would be if prices are consistently falling, nobody's going to buy anything because they'll always be waiting for an even lower price. Well, think if that really sounds like the way people act. Think about you and consumer electronics. You know, as soon as you bite the bullet and buy that laptop, you know that next year there's going to be a better laptop for cheaper. You know that. And yet, do you always say every year, I'm not buying a computer, I'll wait till the better, cheaper one next year, and then the better, cheaper one comes, and then you still refuse because you know there'll be a better, cheaper one the following year? Really? I doubt that. Because what's also working here is time preference. People prefer a good in the present to the same good in the future. So I don't want to wait indefinitely for that computer. Eventually, I'll just say, all right, I'm going to buy it. If I go for a cup of coffee in the morning and it's, you know, 75 cents for a cup of coffee, and I know that tomorrow it'll be 70 cents, I don't say, well, forget that. No way I'm ordering a cup of coffee today. And then tomorrow it's 70 cents. And I know that the next day it'll be 67 cents. I don't say, psh, forget that. I'll wait till tomorrow and then never have the coffee. If this were true, we would defer basically all our purchases until we're lying there on our deathbed. And then as we're expiring, we finally just grab that iPhone. Just not the way things work. Another argument, there's also the sticky wages and sticky prices thing, which I've talked about in the past. Maybe I'll put an article up about sticky wages and sticky prices as why we have to have inflation of the money supply to unstick prices and wages. I'll put something up on that at tomwoods.com/2016. But another argument that we hear is that if prices fall, then business firms, let's say that took out a loan, let's say they took out a loan for $1 million. They have to pay that $1 million back. But now suddenly prices have fallen to a point where that $1 million is basically now worth $2 million. And so now suddenly they have inadvertently taken out a loan for $2 million and they just can't make these sorts of payments. Well, there are a couple of answers to this. Number one, if this is a widespread phenomenon, then you'll just simply have a renegotiation of the loan. Because banks generally, if they can possibly avoid it, they really don't want to be sitting on a bunch of your illiquid assets to make good on the loan. They really don't. Especially if the prices of those things are going to be depressed also. What instead they want is the money. They want the money back. And they'll realize that the money has now gained in purchasing power. So to avoid the situation where they're sitting on giant mountains of unsellable real estate, they can renegotiate. But even if they don't renegotiate, again, this is a misfortune, but it doesn't affect the economy in the aggregate. There's no reason to expect that the entire economy will suffer. It is a good thing for prices to fall. It is a good thing. So we don't need inflation. Inflation is not necessary for a prosperous economy. We never, ever need to increase the supply of money. You could say, the common fallacy is, but if we didn't increase the supply of money, that would be bad because the supply of money has to keep up with the level of business activity, or there isn't enough gold to facilitate all possible transactions. Okay, this was refuted by David Ricardo 200 years ago. There's no problem here with a fixed supply of money. Let's say it's absolutely fixed, and I would hope Bitcoin people especially would understand this. If the supply is fixed, this is no problem. Because all we need is simply for prices to adjust. So if we have double the goods and we have a stable amount of money, then prices just fall in half and we can continue to make all the transactions we want. That's it. Just prices fall, no problem. You don't need the money supply to keep pace with business activity, whatever that means. That just means constant inflation, and inflation of the money supply via the Fed and the banking system leads to the Austrian business cycle. We certainly don't want that. And it leads to a lot more entrepreneurial miscalculation because it's introducing a lot of white noise into prices and into the economy. We don't want that. Now, it is true that let's say we got to a point where gold got to be so valuable that you could buy, let's say, an entire country for 1/1,000,000,000th of an ounce of gold. Well, then maybe the use of gold becomes impractical. But this is a technical question, and then you would simply substitute a different precious metal. The economy would simply move into something else. It could move into silver, it could move into whatever, copper, whatever else. So that's even that's not a problem. Like even if you got to a point where the ratio between the gold and all other goods was absurd, I mean, you know, you could even digitally handle that. Because the way you handle very, very small Bitcoin transactions, you can give somebody an extremely small fraction of a Bitcoin, and it's no problem at all. We could do that with gold, but since with gold, you generally do want to have the coins. If it got to be that gold coins just buy too darn much, then we just move into another precious metal. And that's just how it would work. So anyway, I'll have some resources for you up at tomwoods.com/2016. And with that, I will say thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.